Alexandra and Tristan, hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah. You good?
Yeah, good to see you.
Good to see you too. I mean, I last saw you at IMS this year. Alexandra, I see a lot more often these days. It's just lovely.
I saw Tristan at IMS and I bumped into him backstage at Hospitality as well.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Very nice. Well, it's so lovely to have you both on the podcast. So thank you for being here.
Welcome.
So let's just start off just with kind of the concept of what we're talking about. And what would you say is the definition of neurodiversity?
So neurodiversity describes the range of human brain function. And it sets out that human brains function in a whole range of different wonderful ways. And neurodiversity sort of encapsulates sort of some of the current main ways that the brain is recognized to work, where it's not seen in air quotes as being neurotypical. And so this is encompassing conditions like autism, Tourette's, ADHD, dyscalculia, dyspraxia, a whole range of different conditions, which actually, as we know more and more about it, are seen as being increasingly common. Mm-hmm. And it's now thought that globally, from global scientific data, that around about 35 to maybe even 45% of the global population might have one or more neurodiverse conditions.
Wow.
There's a lot of concurrent conditions as well, aren't there? So if once someone has one, they are more likely to have something else as well.
Are there two that normally go together, or that can it be?
Like ADHD and ASD at the moment. Like I've got ADHD and I've just been diagnosed as autistic as well. But actually there's a really good book that I've read as well called The Divergent Mind, where someone, because with women it's quite different. We kind of show up, the traits show up quite differently, and actually looks at how we can have different parts of the spectrum impact us, whether it's on the sensitivity side of things or whether it's, you know, on the dyslexic side of things or ADHD side. So there's lots of, you can have like spiky profiles and things as well, can't you? Elements of it.
Spiky profiles.
Yeah.
Okay. And so in your own case, when were you diagnosed and what was it that thought, okay, I am going to go and have a test?
So I actually got diagnosed because I had a 20 something year, addiction to cocaine and alcohol. And in 2019, it got quite dark. So I went and got sober. And I thought my life would be really great, I'd be really manageable. And then I started to get really bad feedback at work. And then my psychiatrist said, I think you need to get tested for ADHD. And actually, now that you're sober, it's really apparent that you have got ADHD. So that was the start of my journey. So then I got kind of the medication on the ADHD. And then I started to see more clearly, I realized that there were other things, issues that I was kind of dealing with. So I really fought really hard. And I just finally got my autism diagnosis in August.
In August. So yeah, it's so all fairly new.
Yeah, I'm in my mid-40s. I'm going to be 47 in January, so it's quite late to be diagnosed.
Okay. Oh, is there like an age that people are normally diagnosed at? Because I think I was reading something as well that, you know, 10, 20 years ago, there weren't a lot of people that were diagnosed. So is it kind of more common now that people that are, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s are being diagnosed rather than being diagnosed as a child?
I don't know whether more are getting diagnosed than children as adults, but certainly we've seen an increase in adult diagnosis for neurodiverse conditions recently, principally ADHD due to COVID. So people were, and not just ADHD, but ADHD came out very prominently during that time because people were separated from their support networks. So these support networks and things which they'd had to help manage their symptoms, like exercise, for example, social exercise, team games, those sorts of things, they suddenly stopped. And so in their absence, people were finding that they were very, what we call, dysregulated. They didn't know how to do sort of simple everyday tasks, or they knew how to do them, but they couldn't do them well. Life became very frustrating. And so you had all of these people that were sort of like, you know, kind of all right beforehand, but with this great network around them, suddenly feeling very challenged. And that's why we saw a massive uptick after COVID and during the pandemic. Of people reaching out to get diagnosis, and that was specifically to also get medication to help in the absence of those other things.
I think also with women, there's a lot more women getting diagnosed because the traits, like autistic traits and ADHD traits, kind of present themselves quite differently in women. And so I think like earlier tests back in the day were kind of really focused on those like naughty little schoolboys. That's what people with ADHD were kind of seen as. And because women are kind of more prone to mask from a very early age, and the, like, particularly on the autistic side of things, the things that we get very passionate about, we get very attached to people, and our special interests are what's kind of normal, like we like bands and music and things. So it kind of goes under the radar.
Yeah.
And I think as kind of there's kind of been more information around how those traits kind of present differently in women as well, I think a lot more women are getting diagnosed.
And just to expand on that point, because it's a really valuable one, and goes back to your question, Katie. So women, girls specifically, often have the inattentive subtype of ADHD. So there's three types of ADHD: hyperactive, which is often the sort of classic naughty little boy jumping around at school,
okay,
which is why boys in particular often get diagnosed before girls, because it's visible. Whereas for women, for girls, they often have the inattentive subtype, which I happen to have, where they aren't acting out or seem to be misbehaving, but they can't focus on their work. They're really struggling to do that side of things. And so they often suffer in academic world, which can impair obviously their ability to go to university if they choose to do that or other things. And this is why certainly we see a lot more women later on in life getting diagnosis. Probably about 2/3 of my coaching clients are female.
Yeah, and I think I got misdiagnosed with a lot of other mental health conditions before I got the diagnosis. So I was getting, because you have much more anxiety and things like that, and also for me, I've got a hyperactive brain. So I had a lot of anxiety as well, which I also know is to do with emotional dysregulation, everything like that. So I had been diagnosed with trauma, PTSD, stress, anxiety, borderline personality, and a lot of autistic girls and women are misdiagnosed with borderline personality or bipolar. And so that now that kind of us people know a little bit more about it, that's where we kind of get more of the autism diagnosis as well.
How are you diagnosed for ADHD? Is it a test that you have to take?
Yeah, it's actually very qualitative. It's not like you're being put through an fMRI scanner and they're looking at brain scans, although you can do that side of things. It's actually normally around about a 90-minute test done with a psychiatrist, so with a qualified healthcare professional that has expert knowledge and understanding specifically of ADHD. That's really important that the individual has that, because a lot of GPs and others don't. And they will ask you a series of questions in concert with some questionnaires they will have given you beforehand, to go to your family, asking sort of your experience of being an adult now and also what it was like to be a child, 11 years old. They're looking for the sort of sweeping arc of the condition over the lifespan. And then at the end of that 90 minutes, they make a diagnosis. And from that diagnosis, you can then, if you choose to, access medication. Or for many of us, I mean, I cried. I don't know what it was like for you when you got yours. I cried when I got mine, because it suddenly explained so much. You know, some people talk about the diagnosis being a label. Do you just want another? It's not a label at all. If you spent your lifetime telling yourself that you're stupid, you're not trying hard enough, it's all your fault, and the reason you got bullied or whatever else, it's all because of you essentially just not making more effort or not being smart enough, that suddenly this explains it all.
Yeah.
Well, hang on, I can go and talk at IMS or fly around the world and do these conferences and have these amazing professional experiences, but I can't do my finances. I can't pay my bills on time. I can't do the everyday stuff. What's the disconnect there? Suddenly the diagnosis can go a long way to explaining all that.
Yeah, I mean, the autism getting diagnosed with that is a much longer process. For me, it was kind of a relief, but then also the situation that I was in at the time, I was doing that because I was getting really bad feedback at work. So I was trying to explain why, because my bosses kept saying, you know, why can you do really complex things, but you can't do this? And I thought that the diagnosis was going to help me, but actually it didn't. And that's why I left the corporate world, actually, because, you know, I was met with, you know, everyone's a bit, no one took me seriously. You know, I was told that I was going to be completely off my face on the medication, and actually that caused that rippled down into like even more mental health issues. So I think whilst it was a relief, I was not in that environment, and I think that's why now working in music, because I left the industry completely, I retrained to do something else, but now working in music, I've kind of found my sweet spot, and I'm really happy because I can just be myself, and that's lovely.
Yeah,
be in that position, because I'm very lucky because not a lot of people are that lucky.
Were you working in the music industry, Tristan, when you were diagnosed?
Yes.
Already? You were. Okay, so it's two very different stories here. One, Alexandra, you were in a place where when you were diagnosed, you were then realised you weren't in the place where you wanted to be and you didn't have that support. Whereas for you, Tristan, it was more, okay, this explains a lot and I have that support around me.
That's right.
I think it's also because the environment I was in, it was very corporate, it was very structured, it was 9 to 5. I now know that I can't do a 9 to 5 job.
Yeah.
You know, I can't be in an office all day long, every day, doing lots of meetings. I now found a way to kind of, you know, do things in chunks and do things in a way that are optimal to me. But that's not what, like, the typical 9-to-5 work environment is. Yeah. So, you know, I have the luxury of when I'm a bit burnt out to say, I can't drive into the office today. I'm going to have, like, sleep for a few hours and work later. As long as I get the work done, it doesn't matter how I do it. But a lot of people will be in those more structured environments. And that's where actually they struggle, because then they get really overwhelmed. Because I would get really overwhelmed, because sometimes I could just, like, not start something. And that would make me really numb all day. And then people would think I was lazy, or I was really stupid, or I couldn't do anything. And then it kind of, that impacts you. Because for me, I've only just got my confidence back. And that, like, that, well, this happened in 2019. And the impact that has, because you kind of doubt yourself all the time, even if you're in a much safer environment. Like, you know, I had to ask for help here the other week because I've run out of my medication. And, like, the relief I had when they were like, you know what, we're here to help you. Because before, I was too scared. And there'll be lots of people now that hold their hands up and say, I'm too overwhelmed, I can't deal with this. Mm. And they don't know that they're, you know, they're legally entitled to loads of adjustments to help them.
So really, just going back to before, when you started working in the music industry, was being undiagnosed, did that bring you a lot of challenges in life?
Yeah, because for me, I started self-medicating at a very early age.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I started self-medicating because obviously, you know, the ADHD medication is medical, but I found self-medicating in other ways, and that became quite dangerous. And because we are prone to more risky behaviours, being more impulsive. So having been undiagnosed for such a long time, I was lucky that I changed my lifestyle, got the diagnosis, and I now know what I'm dealing with, and I can build a perfect environment for myself. But had that not happened and continued, because I was going from job to job, I was quite self-destructive, and I don't know if I'd actually be here today.
Wow.
And that's a scary thing. That seems like quite dramatic, but it's quite true, because, you know, when you're just feeling so out of place all the time, and then the self-medicating is the only way they can cope, you don't realise how dangerous that can get, you know. So I'm very blessed that I was able to just
where you wanted to be.
Yeah.
What about you, Tristan? When were you diagnosed, and what challenges did being undiagnosed bring you?
I was diagnosed at 40, so obviously I'd worked in the music industry for quite some time before that. I had a similar path to Alexandra in that I was addicted to drinking drugs up until the age of probably like 34, 35. Got away with it because you can in our business, of course. Mm-hmm. You can put it down to partying and all of those other things. Always turned up for my job, always did my job, you know, masked to hell.
Yeah.
Kept that going. And, you know, it was only my own personal backstage experience, if you like, in terms of having to deal with the fallout of that, constantly being hungover or coming down, or dealing with the dysregulation that comes from your neurobiology being thrown all over the place, that sort of, you know, anyone was aware. But I was very fortunate to have a very good psychotherapist who was amazing, and, you know, she literally changed, if not saved, my life. And you're saying that I don't know if I'd be here. I was at such a bleak place when I started psychotherapy, back when I was like 31. I tried everything else and nothing was working, and I was like, I don't know if I can keep on doing this. It was the compound reasons. I didn't quite know why, but I now know that my ADHD was a very big part of that, because I just didn't know how to process it, structure my world, organize. Just living in a constant state of chaos, just abject chaos. You know, it's like being in a sort of like a life raft at sea sometimes, where all you want to do is walk on solid ground, and you don't have that opportunity. So anyway, great experience of psychotherapy. Got clean for a year and a half, and I do sort of drink and stuff these days, but it's elective. That's a difference. It's not there to self-medicate. And then got a diagnosis during lockdown, like many other people with ADHD. Got the medication, changed my life, and it's like night and day. ADHD medication has the highest efficacy of any mental health medication in the world, bar none. So it's effective for 75 to 85% of people that take it. Now, that's not to say that it works for everyone that takes it. Alexandra, you touched on this point, I think, earlier. That's for many people who are both autistic and have ADHD, it doesn't necessarily work. Or it works for the ADHD, but it can aggravate the autistic symptoms. Is that correct?
Yes, it
does. Right.
I think, but for me, like as I said earlier to you today, like going on your point, like when I was talking to Katie earlier, like I was quite suicidal actually for a very long time because I just couldn't deal with it. But the thing is, you know, with the medication, I can get stuff done.
Mm.
But then the other parts, like the autistic part of me, will be like really like prominent as well. And what I found since I've got the diagnosis on the autism side, having to rediscover myself again, you know, and I went to 12-step recovery and I did all of that. I had to leave that because for me, now I know I was an undiagnosed neurodiverse person. I wasn't necessarily like a typical 12-step, I don't think anyway. And if I'm dealing with that, that's much better. But I'm just having to learn who I am again and feeling comfortable around people. Like we talked about this earlier, you know, like the anxiety I have about, I love music. I love going to live music. But you know, what's brilliant, like at IMS, for instance, having a boss that turned around to me and I walked into Destino when I saw everyone, I was like, whoa. And he was like, tell me what the safe word is. I'll take you. I had my loop ear plugged in and they like made sure that the guys at Pioneer get, like I was able to go into their back bit there. So it was like quieter. And but having that support, but really what people don't realize, it's like I love music so much, but then sometimes just going to a club and I can't always enjoy it because everything else is so overwhelming and the sensory stuff and everything. So I'm lucky that I've got a few really close friends that I can do that with, that I can be really comfortable with and do it in safe environments. But yeah.
And I think just to follow on from the question you asked, you mentioned Pioneer there, Pioneer DJ also, they're a client of mine, and and say just what a great company that is in terms of how they look out for their staff, really on point, making an effort to look after their neurodiverse workforce. And I know, I'm so sorry you had such an awful experience. Awful doesn't even touch it, does it, in terms of what you went through. I mean, horrendous. And there are still companies out there, sadly, that will treat people in that way. Conversely, I think we're very privileged in our industry increasingly to see companies like Pioneer DJ. I was very fortunate, to your question, when I got diagnosed, that I was working at the Association for Electronic Music. AFEM couldn't have been more supportive.
Yeah.
Greg Marshall, who was chief executive at the time, was fantastically supportive, as was you know, Ben Turner, Cross Naziri, the chairs of AFEM, and so were the entire community. You know, I never once felt that I couldn't talk about it and express it. And straight away, it just changes the dynamic because you're not having to mask. You can talk about how, you know, your work's going. Or in my case, my boss, Greg, at the time, like, so this thing that we're doing for ADE, right? So can you just talk us through the event? Because I'm a little bit opaque on it in the nicest possible way, right? And quite rightly so, it made no sense. If you looked at it, I'm like, it's all right, I've got it.
I have got it.
But honestly, but it's in here. Yeah. I can't explain it to you because to do so takes more energy than I can articulate. But after having done a few of those events, I worked at AFM for 4.5 years. After doing a few of those, he just knew that I could do it. But I couldn't express it to him. And I think this is one of the challenges that a lot of people with neurodiverse conditions face. So I have dyslexia, dyscalculia, and ADHD. Some sort of speaking for those people. You know what you're doing and you know how to get there. But because you think in a non-sequential way, you can't easily explain A to Z. Mm. And talking through the alphabet doesn't also make sense and you don't know quite how to articulate it. But you can go and do that thing. That's, again, that's another one of those strange sort of paradoxes.
Yeah. Actually, on that point, there was a job I had. God, it was about 11 years ago or so. And my mum said to me, I think that boss knew that you were ADHD because it was this startup and this startup founder. And he used to say to people, just don't ask her how she does it because Alex gets shit done. Mm. And she just don't
she'll
ask
get
her how
there.
She does, but she's got a weird way of doing it. And my mum said, I think he knew at the time and he just allowed me to be really free. So then again, when I was in the constraints and stuff, but even like last week, you know, here, you know, my rations of medication ran out and I got really overwhelmed and I was really frightened because I had a lot of stuff stacking up. And for me, it's in the presentation stuff. I know what I want to say in my head, but I can't structure it in a proper way. And so I actually reached out to my manager, Josh, here, and I was like, I'm really sorry, but like, I'm really overwhelmed. And I was really emotional when he was like, it's all good, it's all fine, what can't you do, we'll take it off you. And I was really feeling like I was letting people down. And he was like, you're not letting anyone down. And they've all here been like really great and just taken all the stuff off that I can't do. Now, in the past, that's not been possible because people just gone, like wouldn't understand.
Haven't understood.
And I think there's a lot of people now, and I did a LinkedIn post about it recently where I was like saying to HR managers and also line managers, like, go and ask people in your workforce to see if they're all right and if they need any adjustments. Because there'll be so many people, like I mentor young girls now that try and come into the creative industries. And even though they've gone through programs that are supposed to help to get a diverse set of people from minority backgrounds into like the creative industries, they've been placed in agencies where they're still getting bullied. Really quite sad. And, you know, there'll be people that are too scared to disclose. And what they don't know is that legally they're entitled to a lot of things. Because there's a lot of shame that comes with the that being neurodiverse, because you can't do certain things. I get really frustrated because there's certain things I just cannot do that I should be able to do, that I was able to do before. I'm on the medication and I can't do now. And that, and I get frustrated with myself. So, yeah, it's about people checking in on other people as well.
It's so nice that you're doing the mentoring as well. I didn't know that you were doing this. Is this women in the music industry or any
in the
industry?
So basically, from my experience, which I can't, like, can't go into too much detail, but I got really passionate. I was very lucky that when I was getting, when I got diagnosed and I was going through a really bad time, I had a friend of mine who was like an employment lawyer, and she was kind of like, this isn't right. And I've, because of my past, like my addiction issues in the past, I was like, you know, it's fine, it's my fault. She's like, no, not at all. And she coached me, and I kind of became an expert in the Mental Health and Disabilities Act. And I became an advocate, and I started mentoring people within the creative industries. And I've done a lot of like webinars and stuff, and talking about my experience. I've brought my friend, who's a the lawyer, with me to some of these discussions, because there are. We had like in one of the workshops I did, we had one of the global HR directors from a really big agency, and they were telling us, and which is really interesting. So a lot of companies at the moment, there's a tick box exercise that they have to hire inclusively. So they have these KPIs around D&I. So they have to hire these things, but what they don't do is they don't actually train the managers on how to manage neurodiverse employees. So is it really their fault? Like, you need to support the line managers as well, so that they know what they can do and the adjustments that are
That's
available.
Really interesting, yeah.
So you can't really sometimes blame some people if they haven't been given the tools to manage you properly. And I think there's a big piece on education around going, and that's something I've been looking into with some friends of mine, to go into some of the agencies. Yeah. How can managers best support their workforces? Because there's no point in hiring a diverse workforce if you don't know how to manage that workforce effectively.
That's a really interesting point. Really interesting. What factors of the creative industry, or more so the music industry, do you think are attractive to people with neurodiverse conditions?
This idea of non-sequential thinking, I think, comes up again, where if you are in an environment that praises that sort of mind, straight away you feel like you've got something to offer. Okay. So if you go and work for KPMG or JP Morgan or some sort of, you know, very structured organization like that, these are not skills that are so widely recognized. But in our space, it's all about coming up with the latest artwork for the sleeve for this new album, or coming up with song lyrics that are going to be unique, or like a new bit of emceeing or something like that. A new festival concept, or, you know, you look at organizations like Elro and stuff, you know, just bonkers in terms of like the ideas that they pull together. I know a few of the people that have worked there over the years that have been neurodiverse, you know, so that you're in an atmosphere where it's more like the hunter that you are. So there's this idea of us neurodiverse people are hunters in a farmer's world. So that's to say that human beings appeared, we were hunter-gatherers, and then we discovered agriculture, and then we settled. Now, why did we go over the next hill, over the next hill, over the next hill? Because of people like Alexandra and myself going, oh, what's that? What's around the next corner? What's that thing? We can't finish our current job for toffee, right? But we want to find out about the next one, right? So we keep on going over that next hill. And this is one of the reasons why they think, scientists believe, that America has one of the highest rates of ADHD in the world. Not because of some crazy over medication pharmaceutical thing, but because all of those people on the Mayflower, you got it, guessed it, they all had ADHD, right? They're like, what's over there? Right. So this idea that they were all hunters, if you like, seeking out the next thing, the next experience, that if you put people into KPMG, JP Morgan, and they're like us, then it's a square peg round hole situation.
Yeah.
Whereas to your question, our industry celebrates the round holiness, if you like, of us. You know, that this, you can find a groove. You can find a space that's right for you somewhere in that to express your creativity. And of course, the moment that you can start to express your creativity, the moment you can be recognized for being good at something rather than a lifetime of feeling like you're a failure, then of course you can start thriving. And this is why, you know, in the corporate world, we've long since seen people like Richard Branson, who in a BBC interview recently was asked directly, we know you've got dyslexia, we've known this for years, but do you have ADHD as well? And he's like, my wife says if I don't have ADHD, she would fall over, right? And you see it in him. He's an individual that said, I could never run a company. I love starting them, okay? And so you see a lot of entrepreneurs in our space, of course, as well.
Yes. But
it's a space that celebrates neurodiversity, albeit inadvertently, through the opportunities that it affords.
And what about the actual music itself and movement and dancing? Because this is something that we spoke about earlier on, and you were saying how much you love music, and obviously, well, a massive part of what we do in our industry is spending time at events, festivals, listening to music. How does music and movement come into this conversation? Does it help alleviate some of the symptoms that you could have?
I can't go, Dave. I can't go anywhere without listening to music. I mean, I was saying to someone the other day, like, even when I go to, like, the gym and my gym classes, I have, like, in my aqua classes and stuff, I have my own waterproof tablet with my own playlist. And I have to say to the instructors, I'm not being rude, I have to have my own music.
Oh, really?
I don't finish the class because I don't like your music. And one of the instructors, she's so sweet, because that class has about 30 people in it. And one time I got there and it ran out of battery. So she saw that I didn't have my earphones in. And she goes, oh, yeah, okay, what music can I play just to make your life, like, I don't want you to leave the class because you're such an integral part of the class. Now, the fact she wanted to change it for me and there's other 30 other people, that was really lovely.
Lovely,
but
yeah.
For me, it's like music is it's a soothing thing. It's an expression thing. But I think also, the whole clubbing thing is all about unity and connection. Like, we all seek connection, right?
Mm.
And I think we can go and be really uninhibited, and it's a non-judgmental place for us to kind of just be with other people and just kind of, I don't know, it's kind of like, is that just that one place where you can just connect with people without a judgment?
Definitely. And the sort of neurological benefits there, of course, as well, where when we're dancing, we are generating a whole range of positive neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin. You know, that's what movement gives us.
Yeah.
It's part of the reward for movement. So we're benefiting by being in that space, by dancing. If you're working in an environment like the one we're in now, a very cool office space, music can help stimulate the under-aroused brain. So for people with ADHD, their brains are chronically under-aroused. Because of a chronic lack of the neuromodulator, neurotransmitter dopamine. So you listen to the right kind of music, that's going to stimulate you. And then if you're using things like brown noise, of course, that's helping to tamp down some of the distractions, the internal distractions. You can use binaural beats in a similar sort of way. So there's a range of different ways that we can use music, both on the dance floor and in the office space, to sort of get the most out of ourselves.
Is it kind of like self-healing in a way?
Yeah, for me, on my artistic side, I have that because it calms me down. So, like, a lot of autistic people swim, but for me, it's the music side. As soon as I've got that music on, I'm calm. So, you know, I will have, like, I used to call it, like, my happy music. So if I get really stressed, I go and I just listen to music. Like, I was working at a festival and I just messaged Josh. I went, I just got to go away for 10 minutes. He goes, fine. I just stuck my happy music on and I walked away because it was quite a stressful environment. And I just did that for, like, 10 minutes.
And then you're back in.
Back in the room.
Regulated you.
Yeah, totally regulated me.
I wanted to read something that I found really interesting that was in Harold Heath's article in DJ Mag that you had said, actually, Tristan, and it's, when we look at the roots of our subculture, it was anti-establishment. It was something for people who weren't necessarily comfortable in the mainstream. They wanted to look for something different and literally found their own tribe. For people who've maybe felt quite alone and outsidery, underground dance music particularly has always been a safe haven. How has the music industry allowed each of you to be your authentic selves?
I think, so the other thing is, like I said to you already, like being able to connect with people, but when I got diagnosed with ADHD and it was COVID time, one of my best friends is a really well-known MC. And I wasn't very, my mental health was really bad and he was going to the studio, so we had lockdown studio sessions, and he forced me to come to the studio every week and I was making music. Things like we were going with different people to start on a beat, and that just kind of was his way of kind of healing me because I was in such a bad place, and it was just I started looking forward to it. And you know, I wasn't really great. He wants me to go and get in the vocal booth. I told him I don't want to make people's ears bleed, but it was just a really nice way to just regulate and just express myself. And that's the other thing. It's a real healing thing for me.
I think. I still mask, masking being where we put up a certain image of ourselves, a construct of ourselves that we think the world around us wants to see or needs to see, in order to either please them or make ourselves feel safe, or to please them to make ourselves feel safe, you know, like a whole range of different things, but we're not doing it authentically. I've found myself over the years masking much less within our community, within the music industry, because I think, again, there are so many people with neurodiverse conditions here. You know, one of the last bits of work I did for the Association for Electronic Music before I stepped down was a global survey on neurodiversity. So it's the first survey of its kind on neurodiversity, looking at the number of people who have got a clinically diagnosed condition alongside those who think that they might have a neurodiverse condition. So for anyone listening to this, it's on the AFM's website, Neurodiversity Survey 2022. And I think we hit something like about half of the respondents there said that they were either diagnosed or had some sort of condition. So
wow,
it's a huge figure, right? And it's a relatively small sample size of data, but nonetheless, it's sort of maybe indicative based upon those sort of global figures we touched on earlier of like 35 to maybe 40%, 45% of the world's population having one or more neurodiverse conditions. And that's just to say that I think, you know, being in our industry, you're around loads of sort of interesting, curious people and sort of like oddballs like myself where I, you know, come off the wall with the wackiest, weirdest stuff and people are like,
I thought about that earlier.
Right, yeah, exactly.
That's what I did yesterday.
Yeah, big deal.
It's like in this office, I come in here and I go, I'm not the weirdest person in the room.
Yeah.
Quite normal, actually, when it compares to everyone.
We were interviewing somebody earlier and they asked us, oh, what's it like working here? And we said, well, everybody's kind of like crazy a little bit. I mean, everyone has their own weird ways, but it's so much fun. And it's just like, just everybody's very unique. And as we came upstairs, we're having a Christmas pub call on Thursday, and we're getting dressed up. Yeah. And some elves and reindeer costumes had just been delivered. And as this guy came into the office, Alex turned around and went, do you want an elf costume? I was like, this is the kind of thing that happens.
Yeah. This is the kind of environment we want to be working in.
Where people
are either offering out elf costumes or being dressed as reindeer. You know, this is positive.
Exactly. And it's February. No, I'm joking. But if there's so many people that are being more and more diagnosed in the music industry, why are we only realizing or noticing these numbers now?
It's a great question. It probably aligns a little bit to COVID.
But okay.
Lockdown was a inflection point in terms of how our societies identify neurodiversity, because it was brought up to the light. You know, the lights came on, if you like, and then suddenly there's a load of people going, oh, I think I might have this thing, and they've got diagnosed for it. With an increasing number of people who I think are so brave, and because, as from your own experience, we know that not every place is supportive of neurodiverse conditions, and there's still, unfortunately, quite a lot of stigma attached to many of them, for various different reasons, for nothing substantive. But nonetheless, a lot of people feel concerned about talking about it. And so those people that are coming out in the media and talking about it, like in Harold's brilliant article, I think are really helping to sort of enable others to go, well, I'm not alone, and if these people are talking about it, maybe I'm going to speak up about this thing that I've had. Now, if we think about around about sort of, I think ADHD UK and the ADHD Foundation both say that around about sort of 4 to 4.5% of the UK population have ADHD. Now, if we think about the AFM study, if that's sort of approximate at all, we're talking about maybe sort of double that number to triple that number, maybe, have ADHD alone within
the
music industry, right? So then map that out for all the other neurodiverse conditions. So is it any wonder that with the wider population going, I think I might have that, we've got like 10 more hands going up over in our way going, yeah, I think we have as well. So I think, to your question, I think that's why we're seeing such a large number of people now coming out. It's just proportionate to our industry.
Yeah, but I also think there's this whole kind of thing. So like, it's great that a lot more people are talking about it, but there are people that go, oh, well, everyone seems to have ADHD, or like everyone seems to get diagnosed. But what people don't realize is how hard it is to get diagnosed in the first place. So when I got diagnosed in 2019, it was only because I was getting treated for addiction that, and private medical insurance doesn't cover it. There's one, I think, AXA that does it now. But like, so you either have to pay, you have to pay for it privately. If you wait for the NHS, you have to wait years. You know, there are people that like that I know that have been waiting for 3 years because they can't afford to pay for it privately. Same with the autism diagnosis. That's normally like 3,000, can be in the thousands of pounds. I was lucky because you know, the NHS were allowing you to kind of self-refer for a while. They had to close that down. The number of people that were applying for it was just so high. So in some cases, it can take up to 3 or 4 years just to get diagnosed.
Wow, that's such a long time.
And if you, unless you have the money, and then you can. So there have been a lot of documentaries and a lot of things going, oh, you know, everyone's got ADHD and, you know, all these private clinics. But what people don't realise is by the time you get to those private clinics or paying, you've gone through so much already that you kind of know you've got ADHD already, and you're not going to spend that amount of money to get the diagnosis because it isn't that affordable for everyone.
I mean, I was so desperate during lockdown that I melted my credit cards. I was working for a not-for-profit at the time with, you know, the same kind of salary you'd expect for a not-for-profit, you know, music company. If you work for a charity in the music industry. And I was just so desperate. I'm like, do you know what? I'm going to use my card. I was waiting for an NHS diagnosis. That, as you said, was sort of 2 years in the making. I got the NHS diagnosis after lockdown happened, and it corroborated what the private diagnosis said. But I was so desperate, and this was the realization. It's like, hang on a second. I've done 2 degrees. I've done 10 years of psychotherapy, like over 1,100 hours on the couch. I'm clean. I go to the gym. I'm a, you know, health fanatic. Cycle, swim. What is going on? I've got an amazing group of friends, family. Yeah. There's something still not clicking. And the only thing I could arrive at in my case was ADHD, and I spent the money. But it's, you know, it was the equivalent of, like, you know, a nice holiday to Ibiza or something like that for a week. I'm glad that I did, but we shouldn't be having to do this.
No,
this is the point.
Pay £3,000 for me to
£3,000.
We found someone that was going to do it for cheaper, and it was only because I saw within one of my groups that I was in that they were doing the self referral with psychiatry. Okay. I jumped on it straight away, and thankfully, I got in before they closed it because they had too many applications. So I got died. It took me like 6 to 9 months. But, you know, like, my mum was in the end was going, well, I'll pay for it. But, like, why would you have to pay? And actually, for me, the diagnosis, you don't get that much extra benefit. For ADHD, if you have the official diagnosis, you can get the medication because it's a controlled substance. So you have that. Autism, you get a bit, you don't get as much after that. It's just more people seek that, not to label themselves, but to just kind of understand themselves better.
Yeah.
Because you think you're going slightly insane otherwise.
Well, that leads me into my next question. I was going to say, how important do you think it is for somebody that thinks that they may have ADHD but hasn't yet been diagnosed? How important do you think it is to probably be diagnosed to understand a little bit more about how your brain works?
How do you feel? You know, there are people out there that I know who almost certainly have ADHD. They say that themselves. I do. I'm a coach for a living. People that have ADHD, I'm not a clinician, so I can't diagnose, but it's like they're saying they've got ADHD, they feel they've got it, but they're fine, you know, in terms of the hunter world that they found themselves in, the round peg, round hole environment there. ADHD is what's known as a situational condition. That's to say that if you are in a situation that is very sympathetic to your symptoms will decrease. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you are in a high stress environment that is triggering a lot of your symptoms on a regular basis, that's when it gets problematic. And so if you feel that your situation, whatever that might be, is problematic because you are struggling with everyday tasks, you're struggling with work life consistently, day after day after day, that might be when you consider getting a diagnosis.
How do you think that talking on panels and doing podcasts like this, speaking at conferences, articles as well, how do you think that helps people that have been diagnosed, but also the wider dance music community?
I mean, I think from the experience I've had so far, one engagement's been brilliant. So the last panel I spoke at was Amsterdam Dance Event, so ADE, back in October this year. And, you know, actually I reached out to the conference and said, look, you don't actually have anything on your lineup at the moment about neurodiversity. How would you feel if I curated a panel for you? So I put a little panel together. And, you know, we were in a room of sort of like, I don't know, 45 cap room. And we had about 40 people there, which for 11 a.m. on the first day of ADE, really isn't too shabby, right? So that shows straight away the level of interest. And certainly, for me, the best bit of all of these are the questions afterwards. The number of people that come up and just tap you on the shoulder and ask quietly, look, could I grab 5 minutes just to, I've got some questions. And that when you start to go through those questions, that 5 minutes, of course, often turns into an hour or two, which is beautiful. But you realise how isolated so many people are. And that when they hear you talk about your experience and share the wider experience of other people in the industry, straight away they feel less isolated. They feel connected.
There's another thing, actually, because I head up brand partnerships here at Jukebox, and one of the festivals we're working with, I shared my experience with one of the promoters. It was a wellbeing festival, Volnergy, and I shared the experience of how much I love going to festivals, but I get really overwhelmed and things. So he then kind of took that on board, and he has a friend who runs Spectrum First, which helps people with adult ADHD and autism. And so we created the first neuro-inclusive space at a festival. So most festivals I have like quiet areas and gillette areas, but actually we created a space, a separate tent where we had things for people that get overstimulated, understimulated, like sensory things, everything. And it was staffed by autistic and ADHD people. You know, Harold and I hung out in there for quite some time, but actually it was packed all day with people just dropping in, asking questions. And it's the first time that any Spectrum First guys actually paid for themselves. And we're hopefully going to do it bigger and better next year. And it'll be great to have like more festivals thinking about that.
Yeah.
Because people were able to drop their kids off, and they were able to like, you know, buy a Dyson fan, or they were able to like, if they were understimulated during the festival, they could get more stimulated with like using some of the kind of toys and stuff we had. And it's amazing that people don't really do that.
But is the conversation getting bigger?
I think so. And it just allows people like us, because the thing is, we like often don't go. I mean, I'm in a beautiful place that I don't have to necessarily, I can go into like the backstage area or the VIP area, but not everyone has that luxury. But actually, if you can create a space where, because most of us love music and we would love to go to see live music, would love to go to festivals, but we find it really overwhelming.
Yeah.
I did have an experience at a festival earlier this year where, you know, I got called out by one of the MCs, but again, I contacted that MC and said, do you know what, I think you don't realize that some people have an invisible disability. And actually by pointing out that my face was like not as chirpy as you might want it to be, and pointing me out in front of a whole stage full of people, that really impacted me, because I ended up spending the rest of the time back in the backstage bar. You know, because sometimes my face will go to resting bitch face, you know, I will, you know, look like I'm really off or like disinterested or something like that. And I'm already conscious of that already anyway. So for me to go somewhere and having to like I look and all that stuff is already exhausting. So I think it's also, hopefully by talking about it more, we can like educate more people. Because when I spoke to him about it and called him up on it, he was mortified, because he was thinking,
calling him out on it.
Yeah, I mean, he was like, oh my god, I just want to make everyone really happy, like, you know, I just want. But I said, you pointed me out to a whole stage full of people saying I don't want miserable people in my audience, and turn your fan up. And I wasn't miserable. It was just like, I've been working for 10 hours. I was like, you know, I was just like, that was just me, but I'm already kind of self-conscious. So then that makes you not want to go and do those things, you know? Yeah. So I think also that creating that awareness as well.
Just touching on something that you said before, Tristan, about people that come up to you after doing conferences and talking, and some people that maybe do feel a little isolated. Do you have any tips or platforms or anything you can share with people that maybe have neurodiverse conditions, or you know, not feeling so connected or have that support system around them, that you could probably share with people?
For sure. So, I mean, we're really fortunate in the UK where we've got the ADHD Foundation, we've got ADHD UK, there's the Dyslexic Society over here. If you Google in the UK, certainly we're very fortunate, one of the neurodiverse conditions and put in support, help, society, something like that, you're going to see a wealth of different services available. There's some really great information online. One of the best podcasts out there is by Dr. Andrew Huberman at Stanford University in the States, who's done two podcasts on ADHD. A wealth of information, all time stamped, so you don't have to listen to all 2 hours and 30 minutes of it, right?
Forward thinking.
The producer saw us coming. And you can just jump to those bits. And there's also a beautiful one on there all about medication, doing a deep dive there. There's Attitude Magazine, ADDITUDE, free magazine. You can subscribe if you like, which I do. I think it's very worth it. But again, just a beautiful resource for people with ADHD in terms of free information, where you can school and sort of educate yourself.
And also for like on the dance music industry side, you know, Brandon Block himself, a self-diagnosed ADHD person, neurodivergent, he has his Happy Days for Everyone charity. He does his Tuned Out events at the ministry. And he has built a really brilliant community of people who are, but he looks at it holistically, also mental health side of things, everything. But it's for people that, you know, like us, that like a bit of like have been clubbing, but want to kind of focus a little bit more on the well-being side of things. But I find that his events are really good because it's just a lot of really like-minded people in the music industry that are in various different states of recovery from different things. And a lot of them have got ADHD and are neurodiverse. So I would suggest like going to some of his events as well, or checking out his web Happy Days for Everyone charity website.
Definitely. And then in the new year, we've got Get Ahead, which is happening here in London. Mm-hmm. And that, again, is going to have a component to it for people with neurodiversity. And I think to your earlier point, Katie, about this getting more attention, all of the conferences now are making this integral to their work. Go to those, if you're going to these conferences anyway, go to these events, go and seek out the people that are speaking, seek out the other people that are there. You're finding your tribe straight away, okay? This is like a honeypot of other neurodiverse people that are all being drawn to the same place. Go and chat to those people. I think, you know, we all need to talk more to the conferences as well. Like when we were at IMS early this year, I couldn't flipping pull myself away from, you know, the sort of artist, what is it, green room area, because it was so quiet. Yeah. I've got to go and talk. I want to go and see people and be social. But you know, that the intensity that you have from being in those spaces, which you've brilliantly done on the festival level, is so much that you need these spaces. So I'd say to all of the conferences, if there are any listening, please, please, please listen to what Alexandra is saying and provide spaces, safe, quiet spaces for people with neurodiverse conditions where they can go and network and do these things and recharge, but with no music or anything like that. We love the music, right? This is a given, all right? We love the music, but there are some instances where actually just having nothing there, no distraction, you know, a clear visual field, really nice environment design, goes a long way to enhancing the experience for those people that are attending.
Guys, thank you so, so much for opening up and for coming here and having this conversation. It's been really, really insightful, and I've learned so much as well. And I'm so happy that you've joined me on this space to have this conversation. And I'm sure it will also help a lot of people. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thanks so much. And thanks for making the space.
Thank you. And I'll see you soon.